Welcome to Human Rights Education Now, a podcast series from Human Rights Educators USA, a national network of educators dedicated to making human rights education a central focus of preschool through higher education in the United States. I'm your host, Bill Fernikes, a member of the National Steering Committee of HRE USA. This podcast aims to raise the level of awareness about human rights education and help listeners engage with the worldwide movement to make human rights education a central focus of educational programs from preschool through higher education. Welcome to Human Rights Education Now, a podcast from Human Rights Educators USA. This episode continues our conversation with David Scheinman, Professor Emeritus at the University of Vermont and a longtime leader in human rights and social justice education in the United States. So let me move on. You've been in the field now for 35, almost 40 years, and I'm interested to know, given that we're both involved in an advocacy organization, the Human Rights Educators USA, but also in the broad sense, what are some key insights you think need to sort of move the field forward at this point?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I thought that was a good question. And I wasn't quite sure what to do with it. So three things in particular. I mean, if I were talking to a group and saying, here are some things to think about. And one is to link your debate, your discussion about human rights to the local. Talk at the global, and if you don't help people connected to the local, you're not going to hold people and bring them along with you. That to me would be central. And I was sort of slow to come to that, but I've been writing curriculum activity, exploring human rights in your community, which was an activity I developed and I worked out with some teachers, and it was all built around having kids go out and do surveys and interviewing people in the community and having them ask questions about, you know, their condition in life, and then bringing them back and translating the conversations into human rights principles, and then saying, okay, what can we do about it? And rather than doing a whole global hunger unit, what's the hunger-related issues and in the community and what to do about it? So that, to me, the would be one factor that would be very important. I think helping teachers and people see themselves as part of a movement, as part of a larger community working for common goals, is really important, because you're then, and identifying teachers also maybe in your own school who you can buddy with, because it's very lonely doing some of this work by yourself. But I think being part of something bigger than yourself helps to draw people in and to hold people in it. I mean, for me, I don't know where I would have been if it hadn't been for the steering committee and Amnesty International. I don't know. I might have gone along writing a few curriculum activities, but I wouldn't have been I would have just been a teacher writing curriculum activities. And I became something a part of a much larger movement. And I think that's really important for the movement in human rights education as well. And I think maybe a third one would be for teachers to walk lightly, not come with loud pronouncements, not be seen as prescriptive. Unless you're prescriptive for action, but rather than being prescriptive for particular type of action, there's got to be a place for students in the classroom to say, I don't see it that way. I see the need to do things, but not the way you see it. And I think so that we're not proselytizing in the sense of not imposing our own will on our students. But I think we can advance the movement and bring people along by stridence, if stridence is a word, I'm not sure it is, and classroom teaching, I don't think go very well together.
Yeah. Well, let's follow up on that, because I've always found that to be a point of tension. In other words, you can be an advocate that you believe human rights education is important to include in the curriculum, but there's a point at which you can't simply tell people what to think. You need to open the opportunities for people to have exchange of ideas. Is that where you're headed?
That's exactly where I'm headed. And I mean, that doesn't mean you don't advocate, I mean, for a position. I mean, to see the world as an unjust place might be my holding, but students have to arrive at that if that is where they want them to, themselves. My job is not to teach them that the world is an unjust place. My job is to help them engage the world, explore, examine, challenge, raise good questions, and then they say, hey, how did we get to this point? What can we do about it? Otherwise, I feel I'm just promoting sort of almost propagandizing a little bit. So to me, that's really important to do. You know, and I've always sort of prided myself as a teacher that I would struggle to do this. And it partly meant finding books and materials that I use that I didn't always agree with, to share with my students so that they got perspectives as other than my own in my teaching. Yeah.
So let's then now connect to the current climate in this country. In the United States, we have, as you know, a whole series of threats to human rights for educators. I'll just list a few of them, and then I'd like your comments. Challenges to academic freedom through legislation, censorship of publications, restrictions of voting rights, violence against minorities. So, and also the ongoing crisis with refugees. So given all that, how does human rights education try to grapple with that? Given these are really sort of on the edge, right? These challenges are happening right now.
Yeah. It's a really tough one. I mean, the list you want read off could be much longer. Mm. I mean, the assault on democracy, the assault on basic freedoms in many ways, the anger about towards the other and viewing the other as the enemy and the threat. I mean, you shall not replace me, our mantra that the white nationalists employ. And I look at human rights education, and it looks some ways so puny compared to the anger and the great movements that are out there. And I got to keep reminding myself, one, that the education, it's a slow process. Regardless, we can't, in our classrooms, organize against all these forces, but we can constantly try to push our students to think about the vision of the sort of world that they want to live in and how they have to act to, in order to achieve those goals. And I think we also need to become much more active as teachers. I think I'll be seeing the librarians mobilizing around the country in ways against these attacks on access to books and materials. And librarians are a tough bunch. When they take on a cause, my experience with the ones I've seen up here, they're a force to be reckoned with. And I think they will find allies in community because the allies are there. The voices have been quiet because the other voices have been so loud. So the networking, the building, collaborating with other groups, to me is a powerful place. And I think teachers and teachers' unions need to speak out forcefully around some of these issues, up against some very powerful forces with a lot of political power, not just loud voices, but political power, because some of the parties, one in particular, the Republican Party, have done a very good job at the local level, gaining control of state legislatures and school boards and things like that. but that doesn't mean they're the majority. That mean they're a force with power, and I think there are other forces that can need to mobilize, and I think teachers can be a part of that a little bit. I don't know, you know, some of the issues. I mean, I look at the list of, you know, I mean, the violence against minorities, the struggle on the border, all those have a dimension to them that relates to human rights. And if we can help people say, hey, this is a violation of our human rights, and this is something that has to be done with it. But they have to know about human rights. They have to know that there are documents, even though I'm not a great documentarian. We're teaching a lot about it, but I think it's important that certainly the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and many of the conventions against the rights of the child and violence against women and the reference to Native peoples, all of these, I think, are important reference points. And I think we can overwhelm kids with too many of them. But we can, but they need to know that they exist and that they are global and that they are reference points that they can use. So it's, but I think it's, and I'm not sure it's a human right, but we need to talk to people who we don't always agree with without judging each other within family.
Yes, I agree.
Maybe that's the hardest place to do it, but that's work that I think needs to be done.
I think the interesting thing you bring up is the whole issue of changing the conversation. Because in the United States, as you know, the word human rights is hardly ever used. And in fact, it was Bernie Sanders, I think, who really pushed it forward when he was running for president, when he talked about health care as a human right. Very few other politicians ever used that phrase.
You're right.
So I think, and I would also argue, by the way, that the mass media is very deficient on this. If you watch any of the news programs, they hardly ever talk about refugees as human rights violation or about academic freedom as a human rights violation. Part of this is also changing the public dialogue. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how your work in prejudice reduction sort of connects to human rights, because you mentioned the concept of the other, which is the social, the idea of distancing other people from you so that they become less human or marginalized.
Yeah. I smile as you say it, because I remember offering a workshop for the Anti-Defamation League. I think it was Louisville, Kentucky, years ago. And this was way long ago. And I was trying to develop the idea of teaching from multiple perspectives, taking an event and looking at it from different ways. And we did a workshop on, I said, okay, pretend you're putting a plaque on the side of the American embassy in Tehran to memorialize the takeover of the American embassy by the Iranian students. What would you put on your plaque? And you are the Shah, you are the unions, you are the students. And so we had 8 or 9 different roles, and each person wrote a different plaque. And they presented them, and they were wonderful. And they were all different, and we talked about the differences and how important it was. And then a teacher says, yeah, but we should have nuked them. And I said to myself, yep, educational perspectives will carry you so far, but they're not going to carry you. You have to challenge. I don't know. I almost think that human rights has got to challenge the heart as well as the mind. I don't know how far we can go in educators unless we can develop a network of strong community people who are working, who are on consort with us. We had this in our area where we had an argument in our school system over keeping the term rebel in the high school. And we had a little symbol of, you know, there was a soldier who was, you know, and there was the African Americans in the school were feeling that it was not a welcoming place. And we had a big public forum and all sorts of things and school board and votes, and they voted to eliminate rebel. We're now the wolves. but it really drove the community apart. But the community members and teachers brought it back together by running interest groups who would get together in the evening and talk with each other and talk about our concerns and talk about our perspectives. And people were willing to come to the meeting and talk and listen and engage. Right now, I lament the level of dialogue that I see. I mean, it's more of the rant and the assault and the judgment, and on both sides. And particularly being in Vermont, which is a moderately progressive liberal state, I don't have a lot of people to talk to who I disagree with. Mm. And I'm not sure. I'd like to see how we can promote that in schools and with children, so that they listen better. And I think that's a key part of it for me. I don't know, that goes off a bit from what you were asking, but.
Well, I think it's important, though, as a foundation, that if you can't understand what another person is saying, and if you don't give them the space to say it, then it's hard to actually take a position of your own because you're not well informed. You really don't understand that there's more perspectives than your own.
Yes, and it takes time.
Yes.
And it's slow. It's slow.
Right. You know, I think in human rights education, there needs to be more of that too, by the way.
Yeah. There aren't any quick fixes to any of this stuff, but I think it would be nice if we could build this from the lower grades on up, not necessarily talking about human rights, but talking about listening, sharing, all that, and building it as a building block as we move up through the school years, rather than all of a sudden trying to drop some of these principles in the high school.
Right.
In the elementary school.
I think there's no question about it. You have to do it over time. No question. Let me move on to the last part of what we're going to talk about, which is, I mentioned this issue of the challenges of authoritarianism. And that's a national as well as an international problem, as I see it. But where would human rights education fit in attempting to address it? Because it seems like an almost insurmountable issue when you think about all the political ramifications. But I'm wondering where human rights education can play a role in dealing with this sort of rising tide of authoritarianism.
Globally.
Well, it could be here as well.
Well, yeah. Well, we have it here too. Well, I think our organization, the Human Rights Educators USA, is a USA, American organization. I think that's all right for our organization. We couldn't be more as we were starting out. We'd have diluted our purpose from too much. But I think it's essential that we reach out and connect with and collaborate with and build networks with human rights educators around the world, particularly in countries where educators are under stress and authoritarianism is dominant. I think what's really interesting, if my memory serves me right, in most of the countries in Latin America that moved forward with human rights education were ones who were recovering from authoritarian leaders. They could not always do what they wanted to do in the schools and elsewhere during authoritarian times, but they knew that they had to build some foundations afterwards to ensure that what that happened didn't happen again. And I think we can maybe support each other and support teachers and elsewhere with networks of one sort or another and with sharing curriculum and help people to mobilize and support various mobilizations, such as, I think, the present movement in Iran of women principally trying to, I don't know how to define it, free themselves and reduce the oppressions that they have to encounter. But I don't know how I can do very much as a human rights educator to help in liberating somebody, for example, in China, who demonstrates in the street due to COVID restrictions and gets thrown in jail, and who has the right to demonstrate according to the UDHR. And I don't think, I don't I feel impotent at cases like that. And I say, and I think all I can do is work with the people I can work with, and so I support people elsewhere who are advocates. But I'm not going to be overthrowing governments through human rights education, at least not in the short run. In the long run, maybe those things can happen.
I mean, I think you mentioned before, it's a slow process. It's not something that you can, it's not a military intervention. It's not something where you can land troops and say, all right, we're going to do this. It's really changing hearts and minds.
Yeah, hearts and minds got a bad rap as a term because it was the Vietnam War term used extensively. But I think the principle is sound. I'm not supporting the way it was done there, but yeah.
So to turn to our last few questions, as I mentioned, I had a couple of questions that I'm asking every person we speak to on the podcast. So let me start. Who would be the most influential role model for your work in human rights education? That could be someone living today or someone who is no longer with us.
For me, it would be Nancy Flowers. I know she has, but you interviewed her. Nancy Flowers and Christy Rodelius Palmer, who are two people who have a vision and power and organizing skills, are willing to draw people in, attract them, support them, and who have been instrumental for me in help moving me along, who are gentle critics, but critics nevertheless when it needs to be. So the two of them, I'd say, were really crucial. And Nancy, particularly in the early years, with the steering committee for the Amnesty International, she always just had a way, I don't know how else to describe it, of engaging people, of organizing groups, of thinking about how to deliver services of one sort or another that I found I learned more from than probably anybody else. So I think she was really, really important for me. Yeah.
What would be the quote that most effectively sums up your view of the importance of human rights?
Well, you mentioned that as a question, and I went to look for it, and I couldn't find it. We moved to a new house. Okay, there's a quote from Thomas Szasz, who was a psychologist or a psychoanalyst, who was very critical of the involuntary placement of people in mental institutions. And he defined it and talked about it in terms of this way, and I'll capture it a little bit. The struggle is for the control of the word. Whoever controls the word controls the situation. And I think of that in terms of so many aspects of the work I do. I think about the political leaders. I remember when Dukakis was running for president. And the word got associated with the soft on crime, and it became a definer for that event. Mm. So the labeling of people and then the restating them. And I think the challenge for us is to not let others define us and define the word. I think Paulo Freire said at one point, and slightly different, we are the subjects and the objects of history. Mm. We make it, and we're made by others doing making it. And I think those two need to go on, and we need to see ourselves as being both, and we need to see ourselves as controlling those or resisting those who want to define a world in a certain ways that we find antithetical to our values. So I think, and I've used that quote about defining in most of my classes, because it's about multiple principles, multiple perspectives, multiple views, sharing, listening, and all that. So I think it's really been helpful for me just to reflect on it. But in the movement from one house to another, somehow it's gotten buried and I couldn't find it. So
okay. And our last question, if you had the power to make one critical change to advance human rights education in the United States, what would that be?
I would want to see human rights education built into the structures, built into standards, built into at the state and local levels, built into policy as the work of Rosemary Blanchard, who was instrumental in trying to promote it with National Council of the Social Studies, so that there, so our work is legitimized by others, and we can point to their structures as saying, look, this is what we're supposed to be doing. Let's build this into our curriculum. So it gives, I think, some standards that we can push for and live by that would, I think, would be very helpful. I'm not sure it's, there are no panaceas, but I think it would help us a great deal and to mobilize in states to move the human rights education, more be more successful in advancing it.
In other words, to make it more central to the institutionalization of the field.
Yeah. Yeah. And yes. Yeah. Make it more central, but also have it built into the standards so that it is there. And any school in the state or in the country could say, yes, this is what I'm required to do. And this is what I should do. And this is what we need to do. I think that would be important.
Well, you know, that was one of our overriding purposes in writing the book that you wrote the foreword for, that Gloria Alter and I edited, because we felt there really was nothing there to say, if you wanted to use human rights education and teacher education, where would you go? And hopefully that book will be a useful resource. And your foreword, I think, did an excellent job of sort of putting the rest of the book in context and allowed it to have a great foundation to move forward.
Yeah. It's a good book.
Well, let's hope that people read it.
Thanks for listening to Human Rights Education Now. You can find additional information about this podcast series at www.hreusa.org. Our podcast team includes producer and host Bill Fernikes, executive producer Christy Redelius-Palmer, sound designer and project manager Sabrina Sanchez, editor Elizabeth Schwab, and production coordinator Jasmine Chizu Gota. The Human Rights Education Now graphic was designed by Kim Berering. Human Rights Education Now is a production of Human Rights Educators USA, a project of the Center for Transformative Action in Ithaca, New York.